So it's now a few days since the formal appointment of Neil Lennon and 10 days since the appointment after the cup final. So the dust has settled and I thought I'd get someone on to discuss that. But in the intervening period, we've had the Tiki Leaks scandal. So not only did I need to get someone to talk about Neil Lennon, I needed to get someone on who knew how to discuss scandals of leaks and how they're dealt with. So who better than editor of Politics Home website and all-round good guy, politics expert and Celtic fan, Kevin Schofield. So Kevin and I discuss all things Celtic and a wee bit about politics. So this is me, Harry Beery, with him, Kevin Schofield. So with the controversy this week at Celtic with the Tiki Leaks scandal, I thought we'd better get an expert on leak scandal handling onto the podcast. So I am joined by the editor of Politics Home, Mr. Kevin Schofield. How are you doing, Kevin?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm excellent, thanks. You're one of the few guests that I can actually get on and use your real name instead of some Twitter pseudonym. should I have just called you? And we're now joined by at Paul Home.
yeah, exactly. At Paul Home editor, I think it is. I did think should I come under an assumed name, but folk would recognise my voice, so why the hell bother? You know.
My only disappointment, I listened to, and everybody listening to this should listen to the excellent podcast. This week's podcast was particularly good with Matt Ford on it. And I listened all the way to the end to wait for the trailer for this, for you to advertise this podcast on it.
Oh, no, I failed. And what can I say, Harry? I'm really sorry. That was such a glaring omission. I'm slapping myself over the wrist. Exactly. I can only apologise.
So Tiki Leaks, you're a man known to the world of scandal and leaks coming out. So actually, first of all, without getting into the how Celtic should have dealt with it, first of all, as a journalist, how do you deal with something in the social media world nowadays that is everybody's reading, but you don't know the veracity of it? How do you deal with that as a journalist?
Well, you're right. I mean, the first thing you have to do is check out if it's real or if it's a fake, because there's so many things, as you know, floating about on social media, online, that are mocked up. And it's very easy these days, and some of them are very, 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 very convincing fakes. So your first job, I guess, is to speak to your contacts. In this case, it would be at Celtic or in the Labour Party, the Tory Party, whatever, and say, look, this is online. Is this genuine or has it been invented by somebody in their bedroom? And then, so that's the first thing. And then once you establish whether it's genuine or not, then you have to decide, well, how do you treat it as a story? Because a newspaper, you can't just, or online website, whatever, you can't just fling it up. You have to present it in a way that's legally sound, so you're not going to get sued, and in a way that is fair, and that you, so you would have to, for instance, you'd have to go to Celtic in this instance and say, what are you saying on this? So then they would have to get back to you. Then you would then present it as a balanced story in that here's a document which has been leaked. This is its contents. This is what Celtic's saying about it. And that is how you present it as a story. But I think I know from speaking to a couple of the guys who have been dealing with the story in Scotland that there were legal complications in terms of data protection and stuff like that. So they had to be very careful how they wrote it as well, so they didn't get themselves into legal problems.
Because that was one of the things I noticed about it, because of the point you've just made there, the story ended up in the way the press had to present it. They then couldn't write a story about Celtic are trying to sell player X, Celtic are thinking about player Y.
Mm.
They had the story then had to be a document about who Celtic might want to sign. Has been leaked.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
and that became the story. So
the story
is driven by the fact that they couldn't actually say what was in the paper
Yeah, exactly. Because everyone that's listening, I'm sure, has seen it. But that is a frustration as a newspaper, because you are liable for sort of legal problems. You know, you have to abide by a code of conduct, and you have to act within the law, and you can't basically get your paper sued, because it can be a very, very expensive business. So, yeah, you're right. So then the story doesn't become so-and-so Celtic are willing to accept a bid for whoever, and then becomes, or Celtic begin mole hunt, because this is obviously a very sensitive document, which is getting the public domain, very embarrassing for Celtic. And obviously the club is now having to find out what the hell happened.
So you're a proper journalist, so as a consequence of having a proper journalist on the podcast... I'm going to go by your rules, and we can't actually mention the players.
I think it's probably best to play it safe, yeah.
Yes. So, what were your thoughts when you saw it, first of all?
My first thought as a journalist was, great scoop. You know, I mean, it's amazing to get your hands on something like that. And then as a supporter reading it, I mean, to my way of thinking, I didn't think it was as shocking as maybe some... others might. You know, I looked at it and I thought, well, that, you know, it's sensible that they would accept or consider bids for X player, you know, given how the last season went, maybe coming into the final year of his contract or whatever. So it made perfect sense in terms of the business, you know, and it was just basically as well looking at a lot of the players I hadn't heard of, the players, younger players who they're supposed to be looking at, potential loans from down south and stuff like that. So, as I say, as a journalist, I thought, good scoop. But as a supporter, I just thought, well, yeah, I mean, Celtic, as we all know, is run as a sensible business model. Maybe sometimes for supporters, it's a bit too sensible, a bit too cautious. But it was an interesting insight, I thought, into basically how this type of thing works. Because I think, was it April? This was the meeting.
Yeah.
So it was interesting just to see, well, that's forward thinking. That's how they carry out their forward planning into next season. So so-and-so is going to watch this person play, then we'll report back. So-and-so, yeah, his contract's up for renewal this season. We've got an option for an extra year. Yeah, we'll probably trigger that clause for the extra year, that one there, let's just keep an eye on it. It was interesting, but I don't think there was any like massive, you know, scandal. I don't think, without naming names, I don't think there was like a player identified who we were, you know, yes, we're definitely looking to sell so and so, which I think would have been, you know, a massive story. My reading of it was, yeah, well, actually, you know what, I agree with that decision. I think they're quite right to exercise their option for an extra year on that player, and I'm really pleased they're not trying to sell that player there, because that would be a really bad move.
So, I mean, we'll get on to some of the other things that come from it. Your experience as a journalist, because again, not going to specifically mention candidates for this. What are the circumstances? Who the type? What's the motivation behind people when people leak this type of stuff? Is it just somebody's found it in a bin, a disgruntled person, somebody just wants to show off they know stuff? How does this? What tends to be the motivation for it?
Well, what would tend to be the motivation for leaking a document would be to expose corruption, corporate misbehaviour. Hypocrisy, you know, there would need to be a reason for, well, I'm going to leak this because it shows that what they said in public was a load of rubbish, or it proves that the government is lying to us about this and this, you know, so there'd be a scandal, basically, to expose would normally be the way that these things come about. But I couldn't see anything in these documents that exposed any kind of scandal. It just seemed like a normal run-of-the-mill forward planning meeting that any business across the country would have. You know, it's not like a scandal about Peter Lawwell taking backhanders or something like that. It's nothing like that. So I think it's the motivation would appear to be somebody looking to show off that they're in the know I mean, I was trying to think as well. I mean, there was a very, also there's a very limited number of people in the meeting. So clearly this document has somehow got from that person's possession into the possession of somebody else who's taken a picture of it and has then posted it online, I assume. Because I wouldn't think anyone, the people who were in the meeting, what would be their motivation for taking a picture of it themselves and then sending it to a mate who might then send it to another mate who they might then put it up online. You know, it just, it seemed a bit bizarre to me. So it seems more, I think the example you mentioned was maybe like somebody's found it. Mm-hmm. They've stumbled upon it. Somebody in the meeting has had this document, has got rid of it kind of thoughtlessly. They haven't shredded it. They haven't put it in the bin at home. They've chucked it in a bucket and somebody's found it. Maybe, I'm just speculating here, but I didn't really see what the point of leaking it was other than to embarrass Celtic, because it is embarrassing. You know, they wouldn't want this type of stuff in the public domain for understandable reasons. So, but why would anyone who was in that meeting want to embarrass Celtic? So it seems to me like somehow somebody's got their hands on it, and you know how it works these days. It's so easy. Take a picture of something, send it, and it's, you know, it can be halfway around the world in minutes. So, and then it ends up online and causes a massive scandal. But there was no, I just couldn't see what the purpose of it was other than to say, look, how cool am I? I've got this document in my hand and I'm kind of showing off to my mates that I've got it. And then one of them, you know, as I say, posts it online. But yeah, it didn't seem, there was no actual scandal involved. It didn't seem to me as if Celtic were behaving improperly. I think they were doing everything right. But clearly their security arrangements need to be a bit. Perhaps maybe in future they'll have to make sure that these documents are handed out, but then are handed back at the end of the meeting, so no one actually leaves the room with the bits of paper, just in case it falls into the wrong hands.
I suppose the issue is if this was emailed round, and some people, you know, and people are just reading the document in the meeting off the email, and somebody's printed it out.
Maybe, which seems a bit silly in this day and age, you know, when it's so easy just to print something and publish it. It's I think when you're dealing with sensitive contractual information like this that you definitely do not want the outside world to know about, I think it would seem a bit naive to be emailing it round, because, all right, you might know who is receiving the email, but you just don't know where that email is maybe then forwarded on thoughtlessly to somebody else, and then it grows arms and legs, and all of a sudden, as I say, it's online. I think the bottom line is it's very, very embarrassing, and I can understand why Celtic are pretty angry about it.
So some people seem to be getting their knickers in a twist much more than I was, and it sounds like you were as well, about it, in terms of people getting their knickers in a twist about the content.
Well, it's difficult to talk about, isn't it? Because we can't say who the players are, but as I say, there was no suggestion in that document that there was like we're looking to cash in on absolutely essential first team players, as far as I could see.
Yeah,
there was one
high profile player where it says he's going to stay, but we need to consider eventualities just in case. Well, to me, that seems eminently sensible if...
Totally.
You know, a player who comes through our academy that we want to stay and he wants to stay, but if somebody came in with an incredible... If Barcelona came in with an incredible offer for him, he might want to take it and we might want to take it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. I think it struck me as being pretty sensible. It didn't give an indication that there's some kind of fire sale coming, for whatever reason, that they've decided, right, they're going to cash in case we don't make the Champions League, for instance. It obviously doesn't say that, but, you know, if it had said, all right, well, we don't want to take the chance of missing out on another season of Champions League money, so therefore we're going to sell this guy and this guy because that'll make up for the money that we won't make for the Champions League. There was nothing like that in it.
Yeah, there was nothing.
Which would obviously anger supporters.
Yeah, because there was comments about this player, his contract's going to expire and he'll go. But there was other ones where... We've served notice on this player for him to go, but we need to consider all options are being considered and dialogue's ongoing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, but there was nothing, you know, based on the fact that they were saying things like that, there was nothing that then said, you know, this player's set to stay, but we need to speak to, you know, have the agents aware that in the event we fail to reach the Champions League, he would become available. You know, that type of chat.
There was nothing like that. There was nothing like that. So, yeah, I think, as I say, it was the embarrassment factor. It's the fact that, you know, on the back of, as we know, the team leaks every single week.
Yeah.
You know? So there's obviously a problem within Celtic with information leak. I don't know any other clubs that have this issue, or perhaps we just don't care, but, you know, Celtic definitely have an issue with things leaking. And as a journalist, normally I think, yeah, great, leaks are fantastic, but only, as I say, if they expose corruption or misbehaviour or something like that. If it's just to embarrass Celtic, then, you know, that's not on as far as I'm concerned, speaking as a Celtic supporter, you know.
So the two things that did strike me out of that, and I wonder your thoughts are on this, is one, we seem to be shopping in England. That's it. Every player that was talked about, bar one, was playing in England. And then how much needed to go through Peter Lawwell.
Yeah.
The amount of things, we'll speak to PL, PL will speak
PL.
To the agent.
PL gets mentioned a lot.
Yes. So first of all, what was your thoughts about where all these players are coming from?
Yeah, it did strike me as a little bit odd, because I thought the generally accepted situation was that there's no great value to be found in England, just because there's so much money down there. So, you know, you have to pay a premium to bring players in from England, and I couldn't understand that. And I thought we were now in a position where, because we have to find bargains, young players with resale value, as opposed to splashing 5 or 6 million quid on an established professional who should go into the first team and hopefully will work it, but you're not going to look to recoup that money in the future. I thought that we'd be casting a net a bit wider, and I wasn't sure whether is that something to do with the fact that Brendan Rodgers had gone by this point, and I didn't know really how much input. I mean, Neil Lennon had only been in the door a couple of months by the time this meeting took place. So how much is his input of, well, I was looking at this player when I was at Hibs. Maybe that's worth exploring. Because we know that Lennon's record is that he prefers British players, ideally established players, players who have proved themselves elsewhere, rather than maybe taking a punt on them at Celtic. So, yeah, I was a wee bit surprised that there was that they were fishing in that particular pool rather than maybe casting their net a bit wider.
Because the thing that I wondered was two things. One, part of the reason, you know, Gary Parker is not at Celtic, but he's Lennon's mate. You know, if he's not working and I'm Neil Lennon and my mate, who I think's got a really good eye for a player, there was a number of, the thing that struck me was a number of players in the sort of Midlands area where Gary Parker lives. So there was that, and I thought, oh, are they Gary Parker players, or is it a bit early? Or, you know, is it a bit early? And Lee Congerton's still there because his initials LC's mentioned.
LC's there, yeah.
And so if they're Lee Congerton players, then is this the people we would have been looking at anyway under Brendan? Getting back to your point, and if it was, you know, has he got some sort of restriction that he's not allowed to leave the UK that we didn't know about?
Well, I know it's unbelievable. It really is strange. I think it was Steve McGowan in the Mail. I saw him tweeting. He goes, like, the one thing we can say about this list is it explains why it's a good thing that Lee Congerton isn't at Celtic anymore. You know, it was a pretty underwhelming list, really.
Very parochial. That was the thing that struck me. And if you've got somebody... So the other aspect is your thoughts about everything seems to go through Peter Lawwell.
Yeah, I mean, it is obvious, isn't it, that Lawwell just is a micromanager. He has his finger in every conceivable pie inside Celtic Park, and which, you know, I'm not completely au fait with how large corporations work, but I would have thought a chief executive, part of their job is to have people throughout the organisation doing tasks on their behalf and then reporting back to them on how it's going. But it looks as though Peter Lawwell does all that stuff himself, and reports back to himself. You know, it's it's a strange,
Peter, I've done
a
this
strange...
report for you. Oh, thanks very much. That's a great report.
Yeah.
Thanks, Peter.
Well, that's what it's like. Yeah. That's what it's like. It's weird. He just, it must be in his nature. He's a micromanager. I suppose he's got to do something to justify the massive wage that he's on. So he does the job of about 8 different people. But I'm not sure that's a very sensible way of running a big company like Celtic.
Well, the thing that strikes me about it is we have the New Balance contract is up at the end of this season. So strip designs are decided November, December. So from my limited knowledge of working backwards, I would have thought it's either already been concluded or we are in the depth of discussions with either renewing New Balance or getting a new contract in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if he's a micromanager on the football side, then he's certainly going to be a micromanager. I can't imagine a chief executive who's an accountant would micromanage the football side but would leave the commercial division to go away and work out their £20 million shirt deal. Which means he's getting sucked into that too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So how can you be doing that? Well, that might explain why the search, in inverted commas, for a replacement for Brendan Rodgers didn't seem terribly extensive. You know, I mean, if you're doing all this other stuff, how are you finding the time to cast your net far and wide for a new boss? You know, so maybe that explains it. He had Neil Lennon there. He won the 2 trophies that he was brought in to win. So might as well just give him the job because basically you've not really done much else in trying to find an alternative option.
Well, so you've nicely bridged that to talk about...
What a great segue.
Exactly. You've done this before. So we're now 2 weeks down the line.
Yeah.
From the appointment of Neil Lennon. I put it out there in my last podcast. So what was your thoughts on the day of the cup final? When 2 hours after the final whistle, we appoint Neil Lennon. What was your thoughts then?
I think like most supporters, probably the timing of it, I just thought was so cynical and unfortunate, and it was unnecessary. You know, he didn't need to announce it there and then, literally within an hour of the final whistle, or within an hour of getting the cup. You know, it was like, again, looking at it with a journalist head on, you know, that was like a day two story. The day one story is Celtic win the treble. So, you know, make that the story going into the next day's papers. Then if you want a follow-up, oh, and by the way, we've offered the job to Neil Lennon. I don't know, I just didn't see, well, I know why they did it. They obviously thought, right, well, this isn't going to go down terribly well with the supporters, so we'll stick it out now while everyone's delighted about winning the cup. And that'll protect us from flack, or as much flack as we would have had otherwise. And I think, cynical, but it actually worked, you know. So fans were a bit conflicted. Oh, well, I'm really happy about the treble, obviously, but at the same time, oh, Neil Lennon, oh, God. But I don't want to be on a downer because this is like a historic occasion. So, yeah, it was deeply cynical. And but I thought, I just thought it was always going to happen that Neil Lennon, for one reason or another, was going to get the job. And, you know, he answered the call, and it was great that he came in when he did, because the alternative, doesn't he bear thinking about, he did come in and he steadied the ship. And I don't like to think about what would have happened if he wasn't around. What would have ended up doing, I've absolutely no idea. So he did the job that he was brought in to do, but I think Celtic were negligent in not trying harder, as far as we're aware, to look at alternative options. And I'm not saying they should have got Benitez, they should have got Jose Mourinho, you know, or Roberto Martinez, whatever. I'm not saying that would have been in any way ever possible, and I don't think it probably ever was. But at least give the impression that you have conducted some kind of search. And it doesn't look like they did. And it just seemed to me like they went for the easy, safe option rather than maybe try to push the boat out again, because that's obviously why Brendan Rodgers came in 2016, was Rangers were coming back into the league. They'd won the semi-final in the cup that year. They kind of looked like they were rousing a little bit. They fancied their chances, so they sent out a message. We got Brendan Rodgers, and it just looked, in the light of that, it just looked like a bit of an unambitious signing. But listen, it's done now, as far as I'm concerned. He's the manager, so we just have to get behind him. We have to kind of leave our reservations at the door and get completely behind him, because obviously Rangers now, they think, oh, you know, it's on next year now. You know, the Celtic have gone backwards, so, you know, 55's coming type of thing. So we need to kind of be united and get behind the manager, I think.
Interesting couple of things you said there, because online quite a number of people have said that's us. We've done what we did under Martin O'Neill. You know, we went for it, and now the next few years is going to be downsizing from that. Do you think the appointment of Neil Lennon is an indication of downsizing from Brendan Rodgers?
Well, I mean, just on the facts, clearly, in terms of coaching ability, I don't think I'm doing Neil Lennon a disservice to say that it's a backward step. I mean, there's no doubt that Brendan Rodgers, regardless of what you think his conduct, the way he left us and everything like that, is a elite level coach, you know. And he did raise the bar and raise standards at Celtic to levels that we hadn't seen before, off the pitch as well as on the pitch. So I don't think you can deny that it is a backward step. That said, I don't think Neil Lennon's record, his record since he left Celtic, is patchy to be.
To be kind,
it's patchy, but you know, I just think that it is what it is. You know, when he came in and he did the job and he got the treble over the line, I think it would have been, and there's no room for sentiment in football, obviously, but it would have been bloody harsh to then show him the door, you know, as much as I would have preferred we'd gone for someone else. But I just think, coming back to what I said before, we just have to accept the situation that we're in at the moment. I don't think, by any stretch of the imagination, that this means that Rangers are going to win the league next year. I mean, I had to laugh, although I didn't laugh. It actually really wound me up, which I guess was the point. But when they put out the tweet that night that we won the cup, saying, oh, with the smiley emoji and the gif of, is it Arfield who's scoring against us and celebrating, saying, oh, looking forward to the next season, i.e., look, they've just got Lennon, we're going back to the top type of thing. That really, really wound me up, because at the end of the day, they've still got Steven Gerrard, and I'm yet to be convinced that he's destined to be a brilliant coach, you know. Rangers had so many bad performances, bad results last year, the second half of the season in particular, and I think under pressure, Gerrard is deeply, deeply suspect. So they are by no manner of means, you know, now on the march, or have we anything to fear. I think there's money there to be spent. I think that is how the club, you know, starts to get back on front foot again, because it feels like, despite having just won the treble, we're strangely on the back foot. You're on the front foot again by actually spending some money, making some decent signings, and then starting the next season in a positive fashion. So, you know, all hope is not lost. I still think we're clearly favourites to win the league next year. It's going to be tough, but I think I don't think just because we've got Lennon that it's that we should start kind of throwing our toys at the pram and thinking all hope is lost, you know.
You made an interesting point, but at the end of the day, they've still got Gerrard, and that's why I was not in a good place after the appointment of Lennon, and it was one of those sort of downward spirals I was on, where the appointment of Lennon puts me in a foul mood. Then I'm sort of in a foul mood with myself for being in a foul mood the night we win the treble, which then puts me in more of a foul mood that the appointment of Lennon has put me in a foul mood about, you know, it was all that sort of stuff.
I think I sent you a message, didn't I? Because I know that I know that you were in a bad mood that night, and I sent you a message saying something along the lines of, well, look, there's nothing's going to put me in a bad mood tonight. We've just won the treble, so let's just enjoy that. Which is why it was annoying the way that Celtic went about announcing Lennon. You know that it was purely done to give themselves cover and guard them against any criticism. So it was really cack-handedly handled. That said, you know, I made that purposeful decision that night. It's like, right, I'm not even going to think about that. I just want to enjoy the fact that we've won the treble again, you know. So
you mentioned a couple of times about how we put it out in terms of media management. Obviously, being a journalist, that's a thing that will strike you. So obviously, because I get to go to press conferences at Celtic. I'm on the general email when they're doing a press conference.
Yeah.
And I was busy. Well, first of all, earlier in the day, Tom English had started to go on about the dreadful decision for Celtic to take so long to formally appoint Neil Lennon. They'd announced after the cup final that he was going to get the job, and here we were on Friday morning, and they still hadn't formally appointed him.
Yeah, it was odd. That was odd, and I think that just adds weight to the theory that they put out the thing about him being offered the job so soon after the final whistle, just to, as I say, give themselves cover, because they think, well, the fans are going to be too busy celebrating the treble, so we'll get away with it. It was weird, though, to go about it that way. So they said, yeah, we've offered it to him. Neil Lennon then gives an interview saying, yeah, they offered it to me in the shower. But he more or less said, I'm going to take it. It would have been a calamity. I mean, it would have been so embarrassing.
Yeah.
If, you know, a couple of days later it transpired that he'd actually knocked it back. I mean, Jesus, that would have been an absolute disaster. But in terms of, you know, the profile and the image of the club. But yeah, it was a bit strange the way that it took several days then before it was officially confirmed.
The final thing about that, which, if I'm telling tales out of school, you know, I'll get a slap in the wrist for it, I'm sure. But so I was busy on the Friday when we were holding the press conference. I was going out last Friday night when we were holding the press conference, and my email pinged just before 4 o'clock, and it was from the person who sends out the generic emails about press conferences and stuff. So I didn't read the email for about 15 minutes. And I read the email, and at 3:50, the email said, you're invited to, you know, it's the generic email that goes on to all the press. You're invited to send someone along to Celtic Park for a press conference which will confirm the announcement of Neil Lennon. It will start at 4:15.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at the time and I thought, right, so they give me 25 minutes to get there. Brilliant. Oh, and the first thing that went through my mind was, they've obviously forgotten me, and I subsequently found out that one or two of the other blogs who get invited to things, they got the email at 10 to 4 as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, right, 25 minutes notice on a Friday afternoon in the Glasgow rush hour, they've obviously forgotten about us and quickly fired that email out.
Yeah.
Then I spoke to a newspaper journalist, who I didn't speak to. I get a text from a newspaper journalist saying, I didn't pick this up straight away. How was I supposed to get to Celtic Park in 25 minutes at Friday on a rush hour? In Russia?
It's bizarre.
So now, they obviously gave the TV more time.
Yeah.
Because there was TV cameras there. But unless that written journalist is in the bad books and I'm in the bad books, the written press got 25 minutes notice.
I don't understand that at all. I don't see the benefit of that. I don't see why they would possibly do it. It sounds more like a cock up to me than anything. But you're right. I mean, 25 minutes notice. I don't do sports press conferences or anything like that. But you know, if I'd do a prime ministerial press conference, which, to be fair, doesn't happen very often. But you know, if there is one, you definitely get a lot further. You get more notice than 25 minutes. That is always a strange way to act.
It continued that narrative of not being something they were that proud of.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is. It's just a bit underfoot. I mean, you compare it to 3 years ago, Rodgers gets the job and it's like thousands of fans there, and Martin O'Neill, when he got the job, you know, thousands in the car park and what have you. It's undoubtedly an underwhelming appointment. But I think in many ways it was inevitable that it was going to happen. I think unless he had... The interesting thing is, though, what if we'd lost the cup final? Which we could have done very easily. Hadn't he got that penalty, you know? He couldn't have maybe not got back into the game. Would they have still given him the job then?
That's what made no... I mean, Peter Lawwell's usually quite good at dealing with the press. He doesn't speak to them that often, but when he does, he's quite forthright. I think I've said on this podcast before that the nickname in the rest of Scottish football, they say that the SPFL stands for St. Peter Effin Lawwell. Because the rest of Scottish football thinks he runs the place. And, and the rest of Scottish football thinks that the press are in his hand and they jump to whatever he wants. Yeah. Celtic fans might not believe that, but that's what the other 41 clubs think. It goes on. And he's very forthright and direct, and he's dealing with things. And all of this just doesn't fit with that straightforward... up front, in your face, this is what's happening, we're quite successful, we're wanting to do it.
Aye. It's strange. I mean, I think the bar was set impossibly high when we got Rodgers. I mean, it was great getting Ben Rodgers, of course it was. But in many ways, it was a freakish appointment in that he was out of work, he was an English Premier League level coach, and he was a Celtic supporter.
Yeah.
You know, so all those things came just at the right time. Celtic were looking for a new manager, bingo, and I mean, I remember at the time it was still a shock that somebody like Brendan Rodgers would want to come be Celtic manager, but you know, without those three things together, it wouldn't have happened.
So
the chances of that happening again at all are quite remote. For it to happen, you know, the next time to replace him is just billions to one, you know. So in many ways, it was always going to be a step backwards, but it was a question of how big a step backwards you were taking, I guess. And I think that's the problem for the club, is that the fans' expectations have been raised to such a level that they were kind of hoping that we would get maybe not quite Rodgers level, but someday off that ilk. And there just aren't that many players, coaches that fit that particular bill, I don't think.
And the other thing about, as I was saying earlier, about people saying, "Oh, we've taking a step down," and there was some people that I saw online saying, "Oh, this is an indication that we're not going to make the 10. I actually think it's the opposite, because I think one of the reasons Neil Lennon's been appointed is because nobody wants to be the person that blew the 10.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think if we were going for number 11, we might have taken more time over the appointment.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I just think it now again with my political journalist hat on. I don't know why anyone would want to be Prime Minister right now, because it's just the worst job in the world. But, you know, to take over from Brendan Rodgers this season of all season, when you're going for 9 in a row and then hopefully 10 in a row, and coming off the back of 9 straight trophies, the only way surely is down, you know. So next season, we say, hopefully, we only win the League Cup and the league, and we don't win the Scottish Cup. Is that a bad season? I would say it's probably not a bad season, but compared to the previous three, I suppose it is, in terms of trophies. So, you know, you're on a height to nothing. Taking off Alex Ferguson.
The only thing, and this was the aspect of Brendan that disappointed me most, after the invincible season and winning the first treble, I really did not expect us to win a second treble, ended up not being unbeaten anyway. But I didn't expect it to be unbeaten, because I expected Brendan to take the attitude of, right, okay, I couldn't care less about the League Cup now, because I've made my mark, I've had the invincible season, winning the treble, the next step is to prove that something can happen in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And patently, that didn't happen. In fact, in some ways, we were worse the second season in Europe than we were the first season.
Definitely, without a doubt. Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, there were signs of improvement in Europe in the first season, getting to the Champions League, and there were one or two decent results. Obviously, Man City, home and away. And it did feel like there was progress being made. And then the second season, definitely went backwards. I wonder whether that's maybe what made winning the treble, I guess, again, move further up the list of priorities. But my recollection of the second season is that it was miles worse than the first season.
Oh, my recollection in terms of performance is that last season was better than the second season.
Aye, and I think the stats actually back that up in terms of clean sheets, in terms of goals scored, points gained, games won, because we drew an awful lot of games in Brendan's second season. So I read a lot of people talking about Brendan Rodgers. Oh, you know, the first and second season were fantastic, and this season not so good. But that's not my recollection. The second season was pretty patchy, actually.
No, my recollection was second season was pretty patchy, particularly we lost to Hearts, but it was coming.
I was coming.
To Hearts.
You know, they were hanging on. There was that game at Fir Park and got the equaliser and it kept unbeaten run going, but it was kind of like, it felt like the unbeaten run was a bit of a millstone in a strange way, you know?
Aye, because again, I remember thinking when we lost to Hearts, I remember thinking, right, okay, maybe the benefit of losing to Hearts is we'll stop this obsession with we just don't want to lose games.
And that'll
bring the flair back to the team.
Totally. Because you were getting draws and it's like, oh no, that's fine. Because you know it keeps unbeaten run going, but actually we've dropped 2 points.
And then the start, of this season when we were, was it 6 points after 6 games or something like that?
Yeah, you know, I was looking back. Yeah, it was poor. They won the first game against Livingston. After that, it was patchy to put it mildly. It was just really, really uninspiring. I think it wasn't until we went to St Johnstone and beat them 6-0, and that was when they went on a run, went up to Dens Park, and scored 5, and goals started to kind of flow a wee bit, and it was a decent run at 7 or 8 games. But before that, it was grim. It really was grim. And then again, up until Christmas, losing against Rangers, it was pretty uninspiring again.
And then after New Year, that's pretty much when we grasped the title from that point on.
That was it. Yeah, it was that run at the end of January until Rodgers went. Basically, they went on that great run, and Rangers were dropping points, and that's what ultimately made all the difference, I think.
So, you know, in terms of, I agree with you, the problem with whoever follows Brendan Rodgers, a bit like to lesser extent whoever followed Alex Ferguson, was going to have a problem.
Yeah.
The only way, or the best way for the person, for me, who follows Brendan Rodgers, is to try and do something better in European football.
Yeah, that's it. Well, that is the great sort of question now, is it what's more important, making progress in Europe again or winning the league the next 2 seasons? And it's a toughie, you know, when you try to take off your sort of parochial hat and you think, well, actually, you know, it doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things whether we get 9-0 and 10-0. Well, what we want to do is just re-establish ourselves on the European front, but at the same time, you know, the thought of being able to get 10 in a row would be fantastic, you know, so... It's a difficult one.
It's not going to happen because actually, I often, when fans talk about these sort of things online, I'll often say, why does it need to be either or? You know, when people say, let's ignore European football and just focus on the 10. And I'll often say, why doesn't it need to be either or?
Yeah. No, you're right. It'd be great to think we could do both.
I mean, my thoughts are, if we do well in Europe, we get £30-40 million more than our next nearest domestic team.
Mm-hmm.
If we aim to do really well in Scottish football, we'll get £1 million more than our next nearest domestic team. So by aiming for European football, by default, we should be best in Scotland because we'll have so much more money to achieve that.
Yeah, not true. True. Here's
a question for you.
Yeah.
It's an unrealistic proposition because it's not going to happen. Losing the league but getting to the Champions League final.
my gut reaction is Champions League final. But I mean, without a shadow of a doubt. But you're right, it's not going to happen. But if you were given the choice in a fantasy land, I think that would more than cushion the blow of no winning the league next year. Do you not think so? Even if you were to lose the final, getting to the Champions League final, I think I might be in a minority of Celtic fans there by saying that, but my gut reaction to that question was, oh, Champions League final.
Yeah, it's a bit like they won the treble when we got to Seville, and I wouldn't swap Seville for anything.
Totally. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. You're right. Yeah. I mean, and many, you look at it, thank God. So as you look back and you look in the books and you say, oh, Rangers won the treble that year. God, that must have been a crap year. But it wasn't. It doesn't feel, 2003 doesn't feel like it was a bad season.
No, so then the reason I'm saying that is because, right, okay, so that's the most extreme situation. So you definitely swap achieving the 10 in a row for a Champions League final. Would you swap achieving 10 in a row for a Champions League semi-final?
Are we going to keep going back the way?
No, you see, that's the point. You see, that's that for me, actually, you know, anybody listening to this who knows stuff about, you know, that I know about property, that would sometimes be, right, okay, let's start. If we don't know where we are with an opinion on value for something, like, okay, yeah, it's not there, and it's better than that. It's not as good as that. And let's try and find out where we are. So what level would you swap
it for? I take your point. I take, well, no, I think it would need to be the final. I'm being greedy here. I think I would need to be the final. The semi-final, don't get me wrong, would be phenomenal as well to get to the Champions League semi-final. But if you'd give me the choice between that and 10 in a row, I'd probably take 10 in a row, I think.
Right, okay, so it's got to be a Champions League. Right, okay, so...
Yeah, that's it.
So basically, yeah, so I'm to get it right.
I can't stop laughing at the thought of getting to the Champions League final. It's such a fantastical prospect, but who knows?
Nothing's
one
impossible.
Day maybe. One day maybe. Exactly.
So you mentioned something else. You can't obviously have an esteemed political pundit as yourself on the podcast when... Well, first of all, I was going to say when every second of every waking day in newsland in the UK is politics. I mean, there is nothing. First of all, are there many Tims in Westminster?
That's a very good question. Well, there aren't many Scottish journalists at Westminster now, which I think is different from years gone by. I think mainly because of the Scottish Parliament. So there is a Parliament up in Scotland that political journalists can cover. So getting to Westminster isn't seen as maybe as important as it once was. I'm just trying to think. Are there any other... No, I'm in a WhatsApp group with a couple of Labour MPs who are Celtic supporters. I'm trying to think. No, there isn't. I'm just going through every room
there.
Are there
Scottish Labour MPs?
Ah, well, you see, that's the good quiz. I wouldn't say who they are, but they don't represent Scottish constituents.
I was going to say they won't be based up here.
I don't even know if the Scottish MP. No, the one, Ian Murray, obviously, he's a big jambo. Uh-huh. He's Edinburgh South MP. I'm not too sure what the other ones. In terms of SNP supporters, Brendan O'Hara, who I don't know terribly well, but Brendan O'Hara is a Celtic supporter. We're getting a wee bit off topic here. In terms of the lobby, no, I'm pretty much on my own as a Celtic. Well, just because I'm pretty much the only Scottish guy there. So the rest of them are all support English teams if they follow football at all.
So next, I've got a series of quiz questions about politics and football. So next one is, my gut feel is that Jeremy Corbyn and the Umpty Dumpty Conservative candidates, none of them are particularly interested in football. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say. I'm trying to think. Yeah, Jeremy Corbyn, I mean, I wouldn't profess to know the guy at all, but he doesn't give... I mean, I know he's an Arsenal supporter officially, because that's his constituents, his local team, and I might be completely wrong here, but he doesn't give the impression of somebody who is mad keen on football.
No, really. He strikes me as the type of person who his whole life has just been obsessed with political campaigning having a passion for football. He's not getting enough passion in his life to have a separate passion for football.
It's politics, in particular foreign policy, is his thing. I think he's more of a football fan than Ed Miliband was. Ed Miliband used to pretend to be a Leeds fan, and he's certainly more of a football fan than David Cameron ever was, because David Cameron got Aston Villa and West Ham mixed up.
Yeah.
So, you know, in terms of the...
easily done. I mean, sometimes I'm watching a Hibs game, And I think it's a Celtic game because it'd be a green and white.
Exactly. <you know? laughs> we've all been there. Tories, no, there's none of them that I would think are massive. I think Michael Gove is a QPR fan, and I think he genuinely does go to the games.
Right.
So yeah, he's the one that springs to mind as an actual football supporter. But I wouldn't peg any of them as being dyed in the wool football men or women, no.
Nick, I try to think of all the. So the next obvious thing is, will Brexit ever end?
Well, there's part of me hopes it doesn't, because it's very good for trade. It's very good for journalism, you know. It's keeping us all in work, which is obviously the most important thing. I think it will end eventually, but not anytime soon. I mean, I've swung between saying, well, it's definitely going to happen. It's got to happen. because the thought of it not happening is and the consequences of the referendum not actually being the result getting over the line is too awful to contemplate in terms of what the backlash might be. But that's now getting to a stage where, well, it's been delayed till October. Chances are it'll probably be delayed again, despite what most of the Tory leadership candidates are saying. So there's a chance that I still think it definitely will happen. But there's a good chance that it won't, probably less than 50%, but there's a decent chance it won't happen at all. So as an issue, though, Europe as an issue, I think, is going to be, we're cursed to have it in UK politics for a long time to come.
Next thing is, can the main political party survive Brexit in the form as they are now?
Well, that is the $64,000 question. I mean, the European elections suggested that, and we've been here before, though. You know, people talk about the breakup of the two-party system, and there's been occasions where it's looked like that might happen, and it's never quite come to anything. I think it'll be interesting, like, as we speak tonight, there's a by-election in Peterborough, which is a Labour seat. Very marginal.
It's after 10 o'clock, so you can talk about it now.
Oh, is it? Oh, right. Oh, great. Okay, well, it's a very marginal seat, a very marginal Labour seat. And if the Brexit Party, who have only been going a few months, if they were to win it, then that would indicate that maybe there is something actually properly happening, a real change. I think the Tory Party are more at risk than the Labour Party. I think if the Tories don't deliver Brexit before the next general election, for instance, then they are toast. And I think if they don't deliver Brexit by the end of October, which is the next deadline, then they're in an awful lot of trouble, regardless of who the Prime Minister is. If it doesn't happen, and there's a good chance it won't, very good chance it won't happen by then they are, you know, they could really be... You can see what happened to Labour after the referendum in Scotland, the 2015 election. You could see that happen to the Tories down here with the Brexit Party. I'm not saying it will happen, but you can see it happen.
Yeah.
But Labour... Yeah, I mean, Labour are split over whether to support a second referendum or not, but I think there is probably more chance of Labour coming out the other end pretty much intact. They might lose a bit to the Lib Dems. I think Labour are probably, you know, more resilient on the European issue than the Tories are.
As an outsider looking in, it looks to me that Labour's problem is the sort of traditional Labour heartlands of the North East and, you know, basically the industrial areas that are no longer industrial. They're massively in favour of Brexit.
Yeah.
But the intellectual part of Labour, the Islington and all the inner London bits, are massively in favour of Remain.
And that's right.
And it just strikes me that Labour are lucky to note that there's not an election, actually, because they can be both things.
I mean, that it's pretty much run its course, that strategy, but it's been relatively successful for them up until now, that they've been able to appeal to all sides. But you saw that at the European election that started to crumble, you know, where voters were just sick of them. If you're a Remainer, you were sick of them prevaricating on a second referendum, so you went and voted Lib Dem or Green in large numbers. Or if you were up north, a Brexiter, Labour supporter, you probably look and think that they're trying to backslide on Brexit, so you might vote for the Brexit Party. So they're being pulled in both directions. So trying to have a coherent position which appeals to both sides is impossible. But right up until now, they've managed to ride both horses, but it's starting to fall apart. But they're lucky that they're not in power. I think if Brexit was to be a disaster one way or another, it's the government that gets the blame, not the opposition.
All right, okay. And so the final thing for people, many people listening to this might not be that fussed about who's the Conservative leader, but they might be gamblers. They might be gamblers.
Who
should they put their money on? Is it Boris Johnson?
I mean, well, you're not going to get a lot of value. I saw today, I think he's now odds on. I think if you're looking for value, you wouldn't back Boris Johnson. He's definitely the one to beat. There's no doubt about it. I think if he makes it through to the final ballot, the final two candidates who get voted on by the Tory membership, he'll definitely win. But, you know, there's a lot of other candidates in it, and there's a lot can happen between now and then. stuff could come out about Boris, he could gaffe, and it could all just collapse again like it did the last time. If you're looking for... So, I mean, I think Michael Gove, I don't know what the odds are on Michael Gove, but he might be worth a wee flutter. I think he is... I wouldn't underestimate him. I think Gove might be... I think it needs to be somebody who campaigned for Brexit. I think that's more likely. Rory Stewart's picking up a lot of interest just because his campaign's quite edgy and a bit different. But ultimately, I don't think he'd be able to win the membership. So I think you're looking for somebody who's a Brexiter. And it could be Michael Gove. But if Boris Johnson makes it to the last two, he'll definitely win. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But there's no guarantee that he'll make it to the last two because it's MPs who decide on that. And there's quite a lot of hurdles to clear for him before he gets that far. But we'll know by the end of next, or June the 20th, yes, we'll know within a couple of weeks who that is going to be. But as I say, if it's Boris is in the last two, then I think he's pretty much nailed on to be the next Prime Minister.
So you said something there about Boris if he mucks up. So this is the other thing. As a boring old fart, when I was growing up and when you were growing up, see if a politician mucked up, they resigned and their career could be over.
Yeah.
The big thing that seems to, the big difference for me, and it still seems to be the case, like Amber Rudd had to resign, although she's been back in the government.
Yeah.
But the big thing that seems to me that has happened with like Trump and Boris Johnson seems to be this. The modern model seems to be that actually, if you're an extreme person, you can say whatever you want, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even, you don't even need to go as far back to when we were growing up. I mean, like, under New Labour, there was quite, I mean, like, Mandelson had to resign twice, and but it has become less of a thing. People resign now on principle. They resign because they're not happy with the government's position on, so you have quite a lot, I mean, May has seen so many people resign over Brexit, but you're right, in terms of scandal, they try to brazen it out for as long as possible until it's completely unavoidable. So, like, I think of Damien Green, who was a deputy prime minister, who, and there's a whole thing about porn on his computer, and he stuck it out until basically there was there was an inquiry and a report into it, and he was found to have lied.
I was going to say, they found that he just lied about it, didn't they?
Yeah. So that was why he resigned. So he didn't resign about the offence. It was more about the way he conducted himself when the offence was exposed. So you're right. It's unusual for ministers to resign over misbehaviour. It's more on points of principle, and that's just become a kind of cultural thing. Although, as I say, that hasn't stopped Theresa May losing dozens of ministers. I mean, it's a record, I think, for the amount of ministers she's lost in the space of 3 years. It's been pretty remarkable.
And then the sort of final sort of grilling of you on the principle of politics. The other thing is that, compounded by social media, but it just seems to be, it's 24/7 news for you guys. That's your job, and you know people might not want to feel sorry for you, but it just strikes me that you've got to be right in the news from Radio 4 starting at 6 o'clock in the morning when there's always a politician on it, right the way through to Westminster seems to be focused around events happening at 7 till 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah, it's a weird rhythm to the day, you're right. There's a lot happens in the morning, and then there's a bit of a lull. There's not much happens, maybe from about lunchtime until 4 or 5 o'clock, and then it all starts up again. So it's weird. So you end up working early in the morning and sometimes pretty late at night, and there's no way around it. That's just the way it is. It's no great for family life at times. But as you say, it's your job at the end of the day, and you wouldn't do it if you didn't enjoy it. So it's a fascinating, I mean, as you say, no one's going to, you know, cry for a journalist, you know, but if you're in political journalism at the moment, you're very lucky indeed, because we won't see this again probably in our lifetime. So it's an exciting and fascinating time to be doing this job, but it's pretty much all consuming, and it's you know, at the same time, it's massively interesting and very exciting.
So just, I'm trying to think of a way, is there any major event, political event on the horizon that you think is going to come out of left field that will either all of a sudden Nicola Sturgeon's going to call a Scottish referendum and she's actually going to go through with it? Or, you know, is there any major event that we're not really expecting?
I don't think she's... I don't think there's any of the total leadership candidate who would allow her to have it, basically, who would give permission for give the legal power to the Scottish Parliament to do it. And I don't think that actually does Sturgeon any harm. You know, it allows her to build up the victim narrative that, well, look, you know, we're being put upon by evil Westminster. They won't let us, you know, have a referendum. And she probably, at this stage as well, is reluctant to have a referendum because it's by no means certain that they'd get a pro-independence vote. So I don't think we're going to get that. I think, you know, a referendum is a possibility. I think I don't think we'll have an election that the Tories call. The Tories won't call an election because they are, like, terrified of a general election for pretty obvious reasons. But we might end up in a situation where we have one by default, almost. We have one by mistake. So there might be a no-confidence vote in the government and the new Prime Minister. The new Prime Minister comes in, can he command a majority because of the way, you know, the parliamentary arithmetic won't change. So they lose a vote of confidence. Labour can't form an alternative government because they can't, you know, Jeremy Corbyn can't command a majority either. And then inevitably then there has to be a general election. So we might get a general election before the end of the year. That might be the big sort of political event that potentially unlocks the whole Brexit impasse. But I mean, if that was to be the case, if there was an election before Brexit happens, then as I said to you earlier, I think the Tory party would be absolutely wiped out. I mean, not entirely wiped out, but they would be, you know, it would be a devastating for them. I think the Brexit Party would do very well indeed.
I said one more question, but from what you said there, it's made me think of something else, because I just suddenly thought, but what if the new Tory leader can't get a deal through Parliament? Because the parliamentary arithmetic is not going to change.
No, exactly. I mean,
How do we get out of it?
Well, there may be, I'm just reading a woman, the BBC's Brussels woman, earlier there on Twitter, who was saying that actually, you know, Europe, a new Prime Minister comes in, really means business. You know, if it's a Brexiteer, you know, it's like, look, goes over there and says, like, come on, guys, we've got to knock some heads together. We've got to sort this backstop thing. Let's get a deal done, because they don't want a no-deal Brexit either. So there might be a little bit of room for, not a lot of room for manoeuvre, but a little bit of movement on the Irish backstop or something to just change the deal a wee bit. And then the new Prime Minister can come back and say, right, I've won these magic concessions, vote for it, and they might potentially get it through. But it's a big if. I still think it's unlikely. Then you're in, do we have a no-deal Brexit? Does a Prime Minister, a Tory Prime Minister, really want to go through with that? If the economic...
Parliament wouldn't let them do that?
Well, yeah, that... probably not, but not. It's not completely impossible that the government manages, or the Prime Minister manages to force it through, manages to cobble together a majority. I mean, Parliament can only stop it if a majority of MPs want to stop it. But if somehow a new Tory Prime Minister manages to galvanise his MPs and manages to get the DUP on board, you know, that changes the parliamentary arithmetic, and then they can get it over the line. So, that, you know, I wouldn't rule it out. But it's going to be very, very difficult.
I suppose at the end of the day, the ultimate fear of the Tories is losing their jobs to the Brexit Party and Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister.
Exactly. And I think that's why so many of them are swallowing their reservations about Boris Johnson, because they think he's the candidate that can actually win for them and will save their seats. And I think that is the key. I spoke about this on our podcast earlier. That is the key determinant factor for them. It's not so much what's best for the country, it's who's more likely to save my job. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, and I think that's maybe why they're supporting Boris Johnson.
Right, okay, so we talked enough about that. What's going to get Neil Lennon going forward as a result? So what's your prediction? I know we'll be early, but very quickly, do you think he'll succeed or fail next season?
I'm still reasonably optimistic. I think he'll succeed. I do. I think he'll succeed. I think the one thing he's got is experience in the job that Gerrard still doesn't have. I still think Gerrard is flaky. I still think a bit of pressure, and he will crumble. I don't think he reacts well to pressure. He's got a tendency to throw his players under the bus. I think if our recruitment, it all hinges on recruitment. Three or four decent signings, which I think is not impossible, then there's the core of a decent team there already. Lennon gets a few of his own signings in, they hit the ground running, he gets them playing the way he wants them to play, and it's actually his team, then I think we should still come out on top next year. But that's my optimistic assessment of the season ahead.
All right, well, just before you finish, I quickly flicked onto the news just in case there was any shit hitting the fan that you should be getting off to go to. But there's no yellow banners running along BBC.
Well, thank God for that. And thank God for that.
So with that, I will say, Kevin Schofield, thanks very much.
Thanks very much.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Hope you enjoyed that podcast with Kevin Schofield. If you're interested, I can't recommend highly enough his ongoing political podcast, particularly this week's with Matt Ford, was excellent. But if you want to get your politics without too much heaviness around it, with all the crap that's going on in Brexit at the moment, I would highly recommend it. It's a bit more light-hearted, but gets to the meat and bones of stuff. If you want to follow him on Twitter, it's as he mentioned himself, it is at Paul Home Editor, and it's the Politics Home Podcast, is his podcast. So that was me, Harry Brady, with him, Kevin Schofield. We will have an end of season podcast review, and then there'll be podcasts through the summer. But this is me, Harry Brady, saying good night and God bless. Good night. There should be more happiness, so much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love. Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring